I would say let's have an intelligent conversation.
Okay.
And not assume that they're dumb or that this is not part of their lives.
But if I would assume that Yale undergraduates are listening.
Yeah.
Undergraduates, mm-hmm. not my PhD students, mm-hmm. and not my colleagues in other parts of the world, but undergraduates who are alert, mm-hmm. interested, often woefully uninformed.
Yes, right. May have very little grounding in this.
That's right.
Let's say your Yale undergraduates and their parents and friends.
Yeah. Okay. Who are the victims of an American education.
Right. Oh, see, we're in danger of going all over the map. But
yeah.
So let's start.
Okay.
And let's just start with some really basic questions. I mean, I have an MDiv from Yale, and I remember being very surprised about thinking about creeds differently through that. But it's been a few years. And I think some of the questions that came back to me that I think might be on, listeners' minds are, do all traditions have creeds, all Christian traditions? And how do they tend to be used? I mean, let's say as an Episcopalian, which I am now, they are used, they are part of the liturgy. But is that how they are always used by different traditions? I don't think it is. And how are they meant to be used by ordinary people? So that's a big place to start.
Well, first of all, it is one of the differences between Christianity and the other major world religions that Christianity has spawned many creeds. As this set shows, thousands of of pages of creeds.
How many creeds have you collected?
We collected very nearly 1,000 of them and cut it down to, I forget what the final box score is on that, somewhere around 200.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas to be Jewish is to affirm every day, if you're observant, and with your dying breath, if you can, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one," the Shema. And that's really all the creed that Israel needs. And it's been possible to be Jewish now for these 3,000 or whatever years without publishing 4 volumes of creedal texts. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet.
Right.
Enough of a creed to animate the most rapid expansion of a religion in the history of humanity,
mm-hmm.
from the death of the prophet in 632 to 732 in Gaul at the Battle of Tours, Islam managed to spread from the Arabian Peninsula south and all the way across the northern coast of Africa to Gibraltar, and into Spain and on into France in 100 years.
Okay.
with this one little creed. And Christianity sprouts them at will, right and left.
So what is it about Christianity that has needed creeds?
Well, of course, what it is about religious faith that needs creed is that religious faith in general, prayer addressed to whom it may concern, sentiment about some transcendent dimension otherwise undefined, does not have any staying power. It's okay to have that at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning when you're out with your friends somewhere. But in the darkest hours of life, you've got to believe something specific. And specific means something specified and therefore specifiable. And that specification is the task of the creed. because much as some people may not like it, to believe one thing is also to disbelieve another.
Hmm.
To say yes is also to say no. And clarifying what the yes is and what that yes implies for the no within the boundaries of a particular religious tradition, like Christianity, and then in the relation of that tradition to other traditions, that task of setting up the alternatives and then finding a way to say what it is we believe, and the experimentation involved in that.
Right.
I've made a very good living studying the experimentation, trying how they tried on particular words for size.
Yeah.
And some words worked and some didn't. There are words in the Bible, important words, which didn't get into the creeds.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Like what?
Like the designation of Christ as Logos.
The word.
The word.
Mm-hmm.
The word and logos means both word and reason,
mm-hmm.
As in logic. And the Gospel of John begins with the words that many people know. Goethe's Faust, in his study, spends a couple of hundred lines trying to translate them. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, in many ways, one of the most important terms in the arguments about the identity of Christ during the 3rd and 4th centuries. And yet, in the only creed that all Christians, or almost all Christians, have in common, the so-called Nicene Creed,
mm-hmm.
the term doesn't appear.
And why was that?
Well, partly, I think, because of all the baggage it carried by that time. They wanted rather to make use of terms that would clarify simultaneously the distinction between God and his Son and the identity. That problem.
And the identity.
The identity. That is, that when I say I believe in Jesus Christ,
mm-hmm.
I am not saying I believe in two gods.
Okay.
That the doctrine of the Trinity was the effort to preserve monotheism.
Mm-hmm.
The real Unitarians were the Trinitarians.
And for some in those arguments, the Logos image seemed to truly present Christ as another entity.
That's
separate
right.
From God.
As a subordinate, and therefore in the nature of his being, different,
yeah,
rather than distinct, but not different.
But I think, let's say for modern Christians, when you say that Logos is Christ as reason and logic, that might be very appealing. I mean, that might be something appealing that was left out of the creeds that would help if it were in them.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Of course, the list of terms that were tried.
Yeah.
And that didn't get into the creed, into that creed at least, is very long. Subsequently, just to give a more complete picture, subsequently the term logos is used very often in various creedal statements,
okay.
Statements that are intended to clarify, amplify, specify this or that out of the Nicene Creed. So it's not the term was discarded, but that in that particular creedal statement, it doesn't appear. So back to your general question, the need to specify, which is in some ways alien to much of modern religious sensitivity, is nevertheless built in. And in times of crisis, suddenly it needs to be invoked yet again. And so between times of crisis, when you think you can get along without it, if you unlearn it, then the question is whether you'll have that resource available when you need it.
Okay.
And, of course, creeds have also been used to persecute and to exclude and all those awful things that people don't want to do, at least in religion. They're quite happy to be very partisan in their politics, to have strong beliefs about music, clothing, makeup, hairstyles, sports,
politics.
They can be very passionate about all of those things, and they are very sure that there's a right and a wrong about everything except faith in God.
Okay. You know, there was just a passage in your manuscript where you said, yes, many people say, and there's certainly credence to this, that what the Christian life is about is really is acting like Jesus or following the example of Jesus, or there's personal experience that's a part of religious personal revelation and prayer, and all of that matters. But you said there's this question that's raised in the New Testament, which gets raised again and again. It's a question that Jesus asked.
Who do you say that I am? Yeah.
And that question is asked again and again in every new tradition, in every different culture. That actually is so simple, but that really made sense to me, that's an important question.
And
that behaving like Jesus follows on an answer that you come to for that.
Yeah, and that's the difference between Jesus and Socrates.
Say some more.
All of us are in one sense or another pupils of Socrates. John Stuart Mill said, humanity cannot be reminded often enough that there was once a man named Socrates. And that's right. But there are no temples built to Socrates. Nobody ever wrote the B minor mass in honor of Socrates because he calls upon people to learn and therefore to be honest with themselves, but he does not call upon them to take up their cross and follow. Okay. And both he and Jesus died for what they believed, but Jesus died in the conscious commitment to the salvation of the world. And so wherever the message is preached and brought in whatever language it comes from, the language it comes to and the culture into which it penetrates must, at some stage of its maturation, learn to answer yet again the question, who do you say that I am? Because the you say in that question is the culture in which we live.
Right.
He's not asking, who does the fourth century say that I am when it was writing in Greek? That's important, because without that we wouldn't be where we are. But at some point you have to be who and what you are in the only culture in which you're ever going to live, the only century in which you're going to live and die, and in that century you have to answer with whatever linguistic and philosophical equipment you have. You have to answer the question, who do you say that I am? Mm. And so the motto, which you may have seen in also in the manuscript, we do not want to Christianize Africa. We want to Africanize Christianity. and that, I don't know, I'm basically a historian rather than a contemporary theologian. On this, I usually say that everybody's an expert on his own century, and I file a minority report on behalf of the preceding 19. And the history of the movement of Christianity from one place to another, of the translations of the Bible into now more than 2,000 languages, is the history of how one sought in a new setting to not to speak the same thing, but to say the same thing.
Okay.
You spoke quite differently.
Yes.
But and to test the integrity and therefore the honesty and therefore ultimately the authenticity of what you're saying, that's the task of a creed.
Okay. All right, before we go on, would you mind taking off your jacket? Because those buttons, I can hear my engineer. He's going to be saying to me when he's editing this.
Oh, but they have the Yale seal on.
He's going to be saying to me, what is that rattling?
What's that clicking?
Well, because
that's his false teeth.
He makes me take off. Yeah, I'll tell him that. He makes me take off my bracelets every time.
All right.
Great, thank you. All right. Okay, wonderful. We're getting to one. This is great. Nevertheless, we do, let's say, in this country at least, and I don't know about in Africa, but in this country at least, Christians of many churches do still often on Sunday morning, or at least in their baptism, recite or have recited over them creeds that were written in the first few centuries of Christianity. And I think something for me, when I studied theology, I mean, when you actually... Because they are recited and it's rote and they're memorized, and yet modern people don't have any sense of why these 4th century creeds were written, and the, as you say, the experimentation that was going on and the lively, passionate argument that was going on, they don't have as much meaning as they might. And so I'd like to sort of get into that with you, partly because, as you said, you file a minority report on behalf of the last 1900 years. I want to say that for this show, we speak in the first person. I mean, I do what the Institute does. You know, I ask people that there's no abstraction about God. This is all with the integrity of a human life and a human mind behind it. But I think when you speak in the first person, your friends are Eusebius and Gregory of Nazianzus.
Because I speak in the first person plural.
Yes, you do. You do.
And the original text of the creed was not "I believe."
Okay.
"We believe."
Right. Okay. So.
Pistevomen was the Greek.
Right. So there we are. And so I thought maybe what would be fun would be to spend a moment with the Nicene Creed, which, as you said, is perhaps used by most.
It
more
is.
Traditions.
It's the only universal creed.
It is. Okay. And why is that? Why the Nicene Creed? And not any of the others in those early years or that came later?
Well, you can answer that question at a number of levels. My father used to say the difference between a dialect and a language is that a language has an army, and the dialect is just spoken by people. And so the Nicene Creed, what we call the Nicene Creed, which is in fact adopted at the Council of Constantinople in 381 rather than the Council of Nicaea in 325.
Yes. Where is Nicaea, by the way? I couldn't remember.
It's in Turkey.
Okay.
Iznik is its present name, and it's just a dirty little town and crossroads. It's all now part of greater Turkey. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Constantinople of 381 is the present-day Istanbul. But it was adopted at a council called and directed by the Christian emperor.
Newly converted Christian emperor.
The not yet baptized Christian emperor.
Constantine.
Who was not baptized till his death.
Oh.
And so all those years that he called himself, he said to the bishops of the church, all of you are bishops, and I too am a bishop. I am a bishop for the things outside the church, and you are bishops for the things inside the church.
Oh,
but
great.
By the time he was done, he was running things.
Is that an early version of separation of church and state?
Not of separation, but it was actually the term that was invented for it much later by scholars was Caesaropapism. That is, that Caesar, the emperor, is in fact the pope.
Wow.
So at one level, the reason for the universal authority of the Nicene-Constantinopolitan Creed is the political and ultimately military authority it carried. And each conquest by the Roman Empire also brought the creed. Constantine's mother, St. Helena, came to Jerusalem, and it was she who found the sepulcher of Christ and found the true cross. And in the true cross were nails, which she sent to Constantine, and he had them melted down into a bit for his war horse. Onward, Christian soldiers, marching as to war. And as he marched and conquered, the creed came right with it. And so centuries later, in the great modern expansion of Christianity, during the 18th and above all the 19th century, my late colleague Kenneth Scott Lauret at Yale wrote a 7-volume history of the expansion of Christianity. And 3 of the 7 volumes are on the 19th century, which he called the Great Century. Well, it's not accidental. That's also the Great Century of Colonialism.
Wow.
So the religion of the white man, which brought sanitation and money economy and all the advantages and disadvantages of being modern, also brought the creeds.
Well, this is making me think that we should be banning this from modern worship.
And substituting another creed for it, or no creed. It's a plausible suggestion, and indeed, you are in the tradition of a fairly substantial group, particularly in the United States. And we're, as we go into 2004, we are about to celebrate the 200th anniversary of one of the greatest thinkers America produced, Ralph Waldo Emerson, for whom I have great personal affection. My mother, who was born in, you should pardon the expression, Serbia, learned English partly reading Emerson. I still have her copies of Emerson from her girlhood. And Emerson was a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School and was a Unitarian minister and then resigned from the Unitarian ministry because he found it too restrictive. So
that's bad.
Yeah. And so he was quite prepared to believe that everyone should compose a creed different from the tradition. He said to the Divinity School students at Harvard in 1838 in the famous Divinity School address, "You must be yourself a newborn bard of the Holy Spirit." And sing it out. The trouble with that is you do it and then you do it a little bit more and pretty soon you have to teach your children something. And so the best you can do is to teach them what you have and you do that a generation or two and all of a sudden there you have
a new creed.
A new creed.
All right.
Well, and the only alternative to tradition is bad tradition.
Tell me what you value when you say the Nicene Creed. I know you know the Nicene Creed not just in English but in many languages.
Partly because of what we've already talked about, namely that I'm very wrapped up in the whole history of the church, and particularly in the history of its teaching, so that I cannot come at any question as though it had never been approached before.
Okay.
Partly because of that, the singing of the creed is a very important and cherished way of indicating a universality of the faith across not only space but time. To know that in the Philippines this morning, this was the creed that was recited at Mass, and to know that the Emperor Justinian in the 6th century and Thomas Aquinas in the 13th and my late father and grandfather all affirmed this.
Mm-hmm.
And each was whatever the time had made him, but I affirm that. And so the we in that affirmation,
right, and
is
let's
across
say,
time and space.
Okay, and so in the Apostles' Creed is uses the word I believe, and the Nicene Creed is we believe.
Yeah, it's back to we believe.
Okay.
That's the way it was adopted originally.
All right.
And then for a long time it was I,
mm-hmm.
when it was used as a baptismal creed.
Oh.
Because baptism is administered to people one at a time.
Okay.
And so when you ask the candidate for baptism or the sponsors of the infant for baptism, you know, what do you believe? Then you say, I believe in one God. The Apostles' Creed was originally a baptismal creed.
Okay.
And so there the first person singular is the appropriate one. The Nicene Creed is finally the creed that's used at the celebration of the Eucharist in the Divine Liturgy. And therefore, it's we, because all of us together. And in a more profound sense, that also forms an answer to your question. My faith and my faith life, like that of everyone else, fluctuates. There are ups and downs and hot spots and cold spots and boredom and ennui and all the rest can be there. And so I'm not asked of a Sunday morning, as of 9:20, what do you believe? And then you sit down with a 3x5 index card and say, now let's see, what do I believe today? No, that's not what they're asking me. They're asking me, are you a member of a community which now for a millennium and a half, which is, you know, 100 years took just as long then as it takes now, which for a millennium and a half has said, we believe in one God. And so that's what I affirm when I sing it. And I suddenly, you know, I know that the Bach B minor Mass is the great setting of this. My late friend Stephen Jay Gould, who insisted with dogmatic fervor that he wasn't a believer,
mm-hmm.
Was a member, in addition to being a distinguished paleontologist and a terrific communicator, Steve Gould was a member of the Handel and Haydn Society in Boston. And so he sang all this ancient music. And in an interview several years ago that we were both involved in, he was asked about communication with other planets and other worlds, and how should we try to reach people who don't know our language or anything else. And he said, we should play the Bach B minor Mass and say in as many languages as we can, this is the best we have ever done, and we would like you to hear it, and we'd like to hear the best you have ever done. And so he would want broadcast systems blaring across our solar system and beyond it with the B minor mass, including Credo in Unum Deum.
Right. And that for you is the setting of this great creed
sure.
of the church. You know, I spoke with a scientist, a geneticist, who's also an Anglican priest at one point, and he said that with his mentality of a scientist, like Stephen Jay Gould, he thinks of the creeds, the great creeds of the church, as sort of the best working hypothesis we have, the best working hypotheses we have, which is sort of liberating for me because on the one hand, it doesn't mean that we throw them out the window, right? You keep working with them, and you also realize that you're grappling with mystery.
St. Augustine, who wrote probably the most important book about the Holy Trinity ever written, and an enormous work in abstract Latin, exploring if we are created in the image of God and God is Trinity, then how is the human soul a Trinity? And looking at all kinds of biblical passages and all that. And at the end of this enormous work on which he spent so many years, he said, "We have said this not in order to say something, but in order not to remain altogether silent."
Mm.
And that's right. And I'm sure that a scientist feels that way. And, you know, in a sense, I'm a scientist. I work in historical science. I have an honorary degree of Doctor of Historical Sciences from the University of Bratislava in Slovakia. So for me, as a scholar, let's say, if that's the more appropriate term now, the historical conditionedness of all of this, that each of these words has centuries of development behind it, that there was a time when people believed in a universe that had three floors, therefore Christ can descend into hell and ascend into heaven, as though it were a lift in a small building with three levels, and that we can't believe that anymore, etc. All of that is in there, and I can't wipe it out, perform a frontal lobotomy as though it weren't true. But because you have to say something, we cannot but speak of those things which we have seen and heard, the apostles say in the book of Acts. Because you have to say something, and because what you say is what you have received as it then passes through you, not around you, I say what I say in the creed. And it also performs the function of a flag.
How's that?
An identity.
Okay.
By which we are known to those who may not be part of this community, but who want to know what you are. You wear a flag in your lapel, or you fly a flag from your sailboat, or whatever. There is a mark of identity.
And that is one of the difficult sticking points for modern people living in an increasingly pluralistic world. Right? And you talk about this a great deal in your manuscript. You're very much aware of the modern discomfort.
Sure.
The discomfort of the modern consciousness with the whole notion of creeds. And
Yeah, I'm aware of it. I don't share it.
Yeah.
But I'm, yes, I'm a professor in a secular university. And as the saying goes, and some of my best friends have nothing to do with creeds. So the interesting thing, though, is the world is much more pluralistic than it is relativistic.
Mm-hmm.
And those are often equated
mm-hmm.
in the secular West. because there are so many different beliefs, therefore the best thing is not to have any beliefs. But the, all those other beliefs are very firm, as we're discovering now that suddenly we're conscious that there are a billion Muslims in the world.
Yes.
And and the need to have understanding and toleration and to guarantee religious liberty are often, that all those needs are often grounded by people on relativism. Mm-hmm. Because you can't really know anything for sure, therefore you must not constrain others to believe, which is basically what Thomas Jefferson said.
Right. Well, also, I think there's a sort of impulse, it's not always articulated, that if you proclaim a truth, that in some way you are negating the truth of another, or that's an assumption. I don't think that's necessarily true at all, but I think people feel that way. Americans feel that way.
Because they came to their understanding of religious toleration by way of a conviction that religious beliefs are relative. But you see, if we're going to have to wait for 1 billion Muslims to become relativists,
to live in our kind of pluralism.
Yeah. If that's the way we're going to get religious understanding, then we better fasten our safety belts.
Right.
And if I may repeat something I was quoted in the Times a couple of weeks ago. The most important systematic formulation of Jewish theology ever written, The Guide to the Perplexed, by Rabbi Moses Maimonides, Rambam, was written under the protection of a Muslim ruler and written in Arabic.
Wow.
And the most important statement of Eastern Orthodox Christianity ever written was entitled On the Orthodox Faith by John of Damascus, Protected by the Sultan of Damascus. So that here in a Muslim-ruled culture, both of these scholars, for the other two great monotheisms,
make profound
of the
statements
book,
of their faith.
That's right, and that's hard to believe that would have happened in modern Baghdad.
No, but that's where your communion with history and bringing those pieces of information into our modern consciousness.
Yeah, that's
important.
We have to have the, and so it must be possible, let's say within the framework of Islam, it must be possible to affirm the faith of Islam, there's one God and Muhammad is his prophet, as a faith by which you will be willing to live and die. To affirm that, and at the same time, not nevertheless, but therefore, to say that those who do not share this faith have the right to affirm their faith, partly because there is only one God, and anybody who believes in God believes in that God, and there are not several gods lined up as alternatives.
And I can hear that as a very pertinent challenge to, say, Christians in America.
Well, sure, many of whom don't believe much of anything, and many of their churches don't believe much of anything anymore, and their creeds are therefore largely dead letter, because they interpret away the specific content of, say, something like the resurrection of Christ. When an Anglican bishop can say that Easter is something that happened to the disciples rather than to the person of Jesus, that's not in company with the communion of saints over the centuries.
That's
but
the age we're living in.
But
yeah.
You see, but the Second Vatican Council, this remarkable event of the 20th century, certainly the most important religious event of the 20th century, maybe the most important event since the Reformation, at the Second Vatican Council, the Declaration on Religious Liberty, largely written by my late friend, Father John Courtney Murray, of the Society of Jesus, declared the right of religious liberty not on the basis of saying, well, it doesn't matter much what you believe. Quite the opposite. Because you believe in the Christian tradition, which affirms creation of the human race in the image of God, and therefore the inherent dignity of the human race. The title of the declaration is Dignitatis Humanae, human dignity. Because of that, because therefore religious faith is so important rather than because it's so trivial, therefore you must not constrain others, because faith can only be given freely. And you know, in an age, my colleague Stephen Carter of the Yale Law School, whom you ought to interview sometime.
Yes, I know, I will.
Steve Carter wrote an essay one time on religion as hobby, which I'm afraid describes the way a lot of people are.
And, you know, my friend Roberta Bondi, who's a Methodist theologian, has said she believes there's...
At Emory,
that there can be such a thing as spiritual promiscuity. And she says, how can I say that it doesn't really matter what I believe and then claim to care about what you believe?
Yeah. And would you trust somebody who said that to you?
Right.
I mean, somebody who therefore is has already given away the show.
Right. Okay, so we've named this modern problem with creeds and some of the problems with the way we've addressed that. But there is this issue that, you know, there's this tension between the creeds. And as you point out, I mean, even the oldest creeds we have did not come out of the mouth of Jesus Christ, right?
The only creed that came out of his mouth was the creed of Judaism.
Right.
Shema.
And that's good for us to remember, too. Yes. And so there are good religious impulses that say it's not so important to recite words. You know, there's this tension between having the creeds and, on the one hand, experiencing personal revelation and being in prayer and having your own religious life. On the other hand, saying what's important is acting. Is, you know, what would Jesus do is the bumper sticker. But
for one thing, he wouldn't have a bumper sticker.
He wouldn't have a bumper sticker. But I think some of that kind of I think the impulse to say, yes, we have creeds, but that's not enough. That is also part of this
modern rejection. It's necessary,
but not
sufficient.
Yes.
Yeah, every Sunday at worship, I'm a member of the Orthodox Church in America, in the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, which goes back to the 4th century, the chant is, "Let us love one another, that with one mind we may confess the Holy Trinity, one in essence and undivided. Let us love one another,
that we may confess. Right.
And so nobody says that it is the nature of God to be a creed. And the New Testament says it is the nature of God to be love. To get the priorities straight.
Right.
Even just as you're about to recite the creed yet again, let us love one another.
Yeah.
But if we love one another, then for one thing, we shouldn't tell each other lies. We should tell each other the truth as God has given it to us to see the truth. And if you don't want to tell a lie, tell the truth as the church has perceived and learned the truth, then you end up with something that has a distinct family resemblance to the creed.
Okay.
Because we love one another and love our children and love the generations yet unborn, we want to pass on to them what we have been blessed with, which is, among other things, the creed. And the creed is, of course, primarily in the setting of prayer and worship. It's a liturgical affirmation, more often chanted than spoken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a creed is spoken at baptism, but most of the rest of the time, in most of the traditions, it is sung. And that says something, too.
Right.
Because there are things we can sing that we have a hard time saying. And the language of love, which is, in our human experience, a curious combination of spontaneity and convention. There just aren't terribly many ways to say I love you besides saying I love you. We're recording this in the state of Minnesota, in which the old story is of the Norwegian who loved his wife so much he almost told her. And, in one sense, it's a very conventional, repetitive, rote thing to do. To say, I love you. You are the one I love. There is no one else I love. But there aren't very many permutations.
Right.
And on the other hand, it's the language of love is spontaneous. You can't repress it. You comes time to say it, darn it, you say it. And take the consequences. And that's how it is, how God's love is expressed, both spontaneously by God and conventionally by God. God also says, I love you, mm-hmm. and in a very conventional way. And in turn, our love to God, which is always a response to a love that started with him and ends in him, our response to that love is the service of one another and of humanity, but also an act of adoration.
So this is giving me a lovely and exalted way to think about a remark you make in your book that one thing that someone who studies all these creeds, as you've done, is struck by is the sheer repetitiveness of them. Right?
You should try to proofread them all in the course of a few weeks, as we did.
Right.
And then you discover just how you wonder, didn't I read this one yesterday?
No, but it's so interesting because I think that the where someone goes when they hear that there are these thousands of creeds is that everybody's doing it differently all the time, and that's not really what you find. But I did want to dwell briefly on one that I sense is near and dear to your heart, which is this Maasai creed,
oh, yes.
The Maasai people of Africa, which was written around 1960, the Congregation of the Holy Ghost in East Nigeria. I don't know, would you like to read some of your favorite sections from
there? It's like most creeds, it is designed on a threefold pattern of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and comes out of the experience of Christians in Africa who were animists, fetishists, who worshipped things in nature and the mystery of life, and who then upon receiving the Christian faith, began reciting the creeds as they had been taught, in this case by Roman Catholic missionaries, in other cases by evangelical or Orthodox missionaries. But after a couple of generations of that, a Christian community gradually comes of age, achieves a level of maturation where you want to do it for yourself. Do it your way, speaking in your context, using the images of your culture. And The question is, can you do that without sacrificing the integrity of what you have received? It's easy just to repeat, but then it's not your own. It's easy to say what is your own as though nobody had ever said it before. But then the question is whether it's authentically Christian. And I think this one manages to do both of those in a remarkable way. Mm. We believe in one high God who out of love created the beautiful world. We believe that God made good his promise by sending his Son, Jesus Christ, a man in the flesh, a Jew by tribe, born poor in a little village, who left his home and was always on safari, doing good, curing people by the power of God, teaching about God and man, and showing that the meaning of religion is love. He was rejected by his people, tortured and nailed hands and feet to a cross, and died. He lay buried in the grave. But the hyenas did not touch him, and on the third day he rose from the grave. Now, for one thing, the Nicene Creed, as well as the Apostles' Creed, go directly from born of the Virgin Mary to suffer under Pontius Pilate.
Right.
And the whole story in the Gospels,
the life of Christ,
is just leapt over.
And that's what a lot of modern people have criticized.
You go from Alpha to Omega.
Yeah.
And here, see, he was born, as the creed said. He left his home. Creeds don't say that. And he was always on safari in Africa. You go on safari. And what was he doing? Good.
Yeah.
Curing people, those are the healing miracles, by the power of God, teaching about God and man, and now suddenly the Sermon on the Mount is in the Creed,
right,
showing that the meaning of religion is love. And then he lay buried in the grave, but not underground, according to the Gospels, not the way we bury our dead, but they put them into a rock tomb and rolled a stone in front of it. As in the Easter story, who will roll the stone away? And the reason they did that was because of marauding wild animals.
Okay.
And so the hyenas did not touch him as they would have if he had been in the ground.
Right.
And this comes from the Gospels and into no creed that I have ever seen until 1960 in East Nigeria. When I read that the first time, a student of mine who had been a member of a religious order, she was a sister, and she had been in a hospital in East Nigeria, and that's the liturgy that the creed they recited at their liturgy, and so she brought it to me, and I just got shivers. Just the thought, you know, the hyenas did not touch him, and the act of defiance, God lives even in spite of the hyenas. But it's a good example of this motto that I quoted earlier, that it is not enough to Christianize Africa, we have to Africanize Christianity. Now, the dangers in there are enormous.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1930s, under the Nazis, which were a movement that wanted to purify Germany of foreign, that is to say, Jewish influences, and to affirm Aryanism, that is to say, we do not want to Christianize Germany. We want to Germanize Christianity.
Yeah.
Taking the same
right.
model.
And
they ended up
completely distorted.
Denying that Jesus was Jewish, refusing to ordain as priest or minister anyone who had 1/4 Jewish blood.
Which could not be farther from
the original story. But, and so intuitively, one knows that this Messiah creed has has the ring of authenticity, and that Nazi yes. creed does not.
Yes.
But specifying that, explaining what is the real difference between this kind of, as they use the technical word, acculturation, mm-hmm. and that kind, is not easy. And by the time you're done, you've got to be talking about the nature of creeds.
Okay. Oh, it's very exciting, though. It's very exciting.
Well, I've had I've been on this project now just this side of 10 years, starting it late in a scholarly career after writing a 5-volume history of the development of Christian doctrine. When I started it, I wasn't at all sure that I would be able to finish it. I had associated a colleague and former student and dear friend who's been indispensable to the project and who will handle it when I can't anymore. She's a PhD from Yale in medieval studies, wrote a dissertation on women dressed as men in the Middle Ages.
Hmm.
And that's what Joan of Arc was condemned for, for dressing in armor. The title of the book that came out of it was Clothes Make the Man. and she's a trained librarian. She runs the Bridwell Library at Southern Methodist University. And she's a techie. And we needed all of that. Because this collection of creeds, which is the jackets are being printed as we speak.
Yes.
This collection of creeds will have also a CD-ROM of all the original languages.
Will it?
All of the original languages.
Oh. So
Greek and Latin and French and German and Swahili and Chinese and all of that. And it's slipped in there. And I can't forbear. I just some time ago received notification from a foundation to which I applied of a grant which, by foregoing our royalties as authors and the press cutting costs to the bone, will make it possible for us to give 325 sets of these creeds to Christian seminaries in the Third World, Asia and Africa, and
South
America.
It is an expensive and precious set
that's
of books.
So it's $1,000 a set.
Yes, that's
and that's a year's salary in a lot of those countries.
Yeah, that's
and
wonderful.
We're going to be. It's going to be possible for us, thanks to that foundation gift, to place these sets there in these places that are so struggling to survive, where I'm sure it will be cherished in a way that we who have too much. Can't even understand. But I was just so grateful that came along. Most seminary libraries, many college and university libraries, public libraries, and a surprising number of individuals have ordered the whole set. And the my companion volume to it, which is 700 or 800 pages, depending on how you count them, will be coming out in paper separately next fall, so that it will be possible for an individual student or minister or interested layman to get that, and then using that to consult the other volumes in the library. So I'm hoping that will achieve a broad circulation. There's been nothing quite like it since 1877.
Yes, yeah,
exactly 125 years.
You know, so you are one of the great religious historians, I believe, theological minds of our time, and I can't. Not ask you about your conversion. In 1998, you converted from Lutheran tradition, in which you had grown up, to Eastern Orthodoxy. And I just wondered, I mean, I'm sure we could talk about that for hours on its in its own right.
I could, but I won't.
You could, but you won't. But I wonder, just given what we've been talking about the creeds, how does your reverence for and your knowledge of this kind of Christian expression, you know, how is that part of your reasons for this conversion?
The centrality of tradition as a force, as the bearer of the message, as what the church believes, even if I don't believe anything at a particular moment, and the capacity of tradition to sustain itself and to sustain the church is something with which I have been impressed, partly through my own studies and partly by my faith, and the realization that, of course, there was tradition before there was a Bible.
Right.
That the Bible came out of tradition.
Couple of hundred years.
And then tradition went on interpreting the Bible.
Yes.
After the last book of the Bible had been written. And a deep awareness, and I suppose a deepening awareness, historically, of not only change, which is how historians earn their groceries. The chapter titles of a book in history are of turning points.
Okay.
So change, but a deepening awareness not only of change but of continuity. I have never seen it in print, except when I've put it in print. See your friendly local bookseller. I've never seen it in print that every day since the middle of the first century, Christians have gathered together around bread and wine, thanked God, and received it as the body and blood of Christ. That there has been no day when that didn't happen. Yeah. Now, the doctrines about it have changed, the liturgical forms have changed, all of that, and it's in many, many different languages. But that this has happened every day. What you multiply 2,000 by 365 with an extra day for leap years, that's a massive continuity. And everything else is sort of trivial over against this kind of continuity. And that it's not only that, but in so many other ways. And creeds represent that. Molière's Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, he discovered one day that he had been speaking prose all his life. And so I sort of discovered that I'd been speaking Orthodox all my life.
Okay.
And so I didn't really convert.
Okay.
Convert is to change. And I didn't change.
I
simply discovered the continuity that had been there all along.
Well, is that what change is often about? I don't know.
I suppose.
There's this wonderful quote from John Henry Newman, another great convert.
Yes, I know.
Anglican back to, he might say, Roman Catholicism.
Well, you know, the church out of which your church came is always an option.
Yeah.
And in answer to your larger question about this, Newman was 44 when he made the change, 1845. And he wrote a book which is now 700 pages to explain it.
Right.
And so I, having done so when I was 74, would have to write 1,000 pages. And I'm more interested in other theologians than I am in myself, so I'd rather spend whatever time God gives me reading Basil of Caesarea than reading myself.
Well, Well, I'm going to let you go in a minute because I know you want to go to church.
No,
but
that's right.
You know, John, I want to keep going for just a minute on this interplay between continuity and change. I mean, he wrote, "In a higher world, it is otherwise, but here below, to live is to change, and to be perfect, i.e., mature, is to have changed often." Which, in some ways, is an answer to the proposition that maybe there's something utterly flawed with the whole notion of creeds, since they're constantly being updated and played with.
Or maybe there's something flawed with the notion of constantly updating them,
right.
which is quite another matter.
Yeah.
Another convert from Anglicanism, but this time to Orthodoxy, my friend, His Grace Bishop Callistus Ware,
mm-hmm.
When he became Orthodox after having been Anglican, his friends at Oxford asked him, "Doesn't it distress you to leave the church of your fathers?" And he said, "You don't understand." He could say it in his British accent. "I have returned to the church of my fathers." And of course, that's what Newman did as well. And in many ways, people have indeed drawn the parallel with Newman.
He
came out of the study of the Greek fathers, as I did, and in many ways, Newman would have been more at home in Orthodoxy than in 19th century Roman Catholicism. He became a Roman Catholic in 1845. And 25 years later was the First Vatican Council and the proclamation of papal infallibility, and Newman was extremely uncomfortable with that.
And let's note the fact also that, in some contrast to the trend we've spoken about a lot, which is this modern discomfort with creeds and with tradition, or with the notions of those things, there is another movement going on of conversion, let's say, or... back to continuity.
Let's say recovery.
Recovery into Orthodox tradition, into Eastern Orthodoxy, and also into more traditional forms of other Christian traditions.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of that is among
young people.
Common people and
yeah.
young people.
Yeah.
And to put it in a world perspective, remember that the major lands of Eastern Orthodoxy have been under the tyranny of atheism through most of the 20th century. And communism, which was dedicated not simply to proclaiming its atheist teaching, but to wiping out religious faith. So that in the Church of Russia, you know, there's 100 priests at one point. And nevertheless, the continuity was there.
Mm-hmm.
Little old ladies smuggling their grandchildren out of the house to have them baptized when the atheist parents didn't know it. And now suddenly that's coming back. So yes, there's been a very strong movement of recovery, and of course that's not confined to Christianity. The same has been true in Judaism.
Yes, yes.
When you know, American Reform Judaism was at one point not very far removed, let's say, from Unitarianism. And in a variety of ways, Hebrew has come back.
Mm-hmm.
The study of Hebrew scripture has come back.
Conversion to Orthodox Judaism.
You bet. And,
yes.
But even the Reform liturgy is much more Orthodox than it used to be.
Yes. And tell me, do you see this trend at all, even in a secular place, even, say, among your students at Yale, whether it's expressing itself religiously or not?
Well, some of it is expressing itself religiously, but then more generally, I gave the Jefferson Lecture for the National Endowment for the Humanities in 1983 under the title "The Vindication of Tradition." And the growing awareness of our heritage and of the need to understand it, to come to terms with it, and perhaps even to reaffirm it, is indeed very widespread. It's partly sociological. The grandchildren and great-grandchildren of immigrants whose parents became 110% American in the kitchen and everywhere else, and who now suddenly would like to be able to speak their language that their parents brought to Ellis Island, and they'd like to be able to cook the way their parents or grandparents did. So that, you know, at various levels, some of which are utterly sentimental and some of which are pretty hard-headed realistic,
yeah.
The realization that that it's part of your DNA, and that
tradition,
and that's why Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof opens the play by affirming tradition. There's a heartbreak to what happens to tradition in Fiddler on the Roof, and yet by the time it's over, tradition is still being affirmed.
Okay. I think that might be your last word. I like it. I would like to allow you to...
At my age, when you say last word.
Yeah.
Let's say last word for now.
Just last word for now. You use the analogy of a CD.
Yeah.
To talk about, to give a sort of physical image for this interplay of continuity and change.
Yeah, I was quite pleased with myself when I came upon that because I thought it was really quite fitting. Now, what I said was there is nothing imaginable more static than a CD. You know, you can stack up 100 of them, go into a store and have a bewildering array, thousands and thousands of them. You can buy them, sell them, store them, bequeath them to your children and grandchildren, and they remain utterly inert. And a savage or a Martian coming upon one of these pieces of metal, having no idea what it is, and I might use it to as a coaster on which you'd put a glass so that you don't stain a tablecloth. And then all you have to do is to take that metal disc and put it in a special machine, press a couple of buttons, which even I have learned to do, and suddenly it's a Beethoven quartet or Mozart Ave Verum Corpus or the Nicene Creed from the B minor Mass. And so it is with creeds. They're inert, they're static. Memorize them or don't, and pass them on, and people, as I like to say, make the sign of the cross with their fingers crossed, they're not believed for a while somewhere, but they're still there. And along comes Stalin, and suddenly Russian Christians gathering in hidden places. What do they say to each other? You know what they said? They said the Nicene Creed in Church Slavonic. That's what they said. Mm-hmm. They didn't make it up as they went along.
Mm-hmm.
They affirmed it. And so suddenly the CD was music again.
Right. And the Maasai imprint their culture and their language and understanding.
That's right.
And it sings.
And it sings.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Krista. Enjoyed it.
Okay.